Okay, so good afternoon and welcome back. We are well underway with the year. Cabinet today had a good discussion about the year ahead and we had a busy agenda of items to consider. Tomorrow, as you'll be aware, I'll be giving a speech in Auckland. I'll be mapping out the year ahead, the economy, and discussing in particular the government's main priorities over the next 3 years. Also, in terms of my schedule over the next couple of weeks, as well as the Australian visit, we have our next cabinet meeting next Tuesday and our first caucus, a full-day event at Premier House next Wednesday. We will, of course, have our usual events. I'll be attending as part of the Waitangi Day celebrations, and Parliament kicks off on Tuesday the 7th of February, so all in all, it's going to be a fairly busy start to the year. In terms of the Australian visit, as you know, this will be happening during the weekend and include a bilateral meeting with the Prime Minister Gillard and a joint meeting of the Cabinet Ministers. Seven ministers will be travelling with me to Melbourne, and each of those ministers has meetings over the weekend with their counterparts. The opportunity for two prime ministers and seven ministers on each side of the Tasman to share ideas on the challenges we face is extremely valuable, and Australia, of course, is our most important relationship, so we look forward to engaging with the Australians over the weekend. The willingness on both sides of the Tasman to make this happen reflects how important that relationship is both to Australia and to New Zealand. Three broad topic areas have been agreed upon for the joint meeting. They are the economic challenges Australia and New Zealand in the Asian century and the future of the Trans-Tasman relationship. We leave for Australia on Friday evening and I'm returning on Sunday night. Really, that's it. I'm sure we've got a whole series of questions you'd like to ask me. So,
Prime Minister, have you been made aware of the Overseas Investment Office's recommendation on the Tasman meeting?
Well, what I'd say is that there was a brief discussion at Cabinet today. The process is a very important one for you to understand, which is that the Overseas Investment Office has made a recommendation. They then make that recommendation to two ministers who have sole responsibility for making that decision. They'll make that decision and they'll make the decision public in the foreseeable future.
So you know the recommendation now?
I have a sense of what the recommendation is, but in due course, those ministers that are charged with the responsibility of making their decision will make that decision.
Do those ministers have a sense of what you would like that decision?
No, because it's not appropriate for me to be involved in that decision-making process. The law is quite clear. It spells out that the two ministers, which are Maurice Williams in terms of land information and Jonathan Coleman as delegation's associate finance, have the sole responsibility for making that decision.
What is your view?
I don't want to offer a view because I don't think it's appropriate to do so.
Do you think they will be able to come to a view before the 31st of January?
Well, I understand that's the date that's been set by the receivers, so I'm sure the ministers will have that in mind and in due course make that decision.
So are you confident that is there any risk that they may not be able to make that deadline?
I wouldn't want to speculate on that. That's a matter for them. You need to take it up to their offices.
So Labour have been campaigning on it today. Is there any sense of xenophobia
Well, I mean, I think there's a few things that are important to understand. I mean, firstly, it was a national government that actually toughened up the legislation when it comes to the Overseas Investment Act recently. Secondly, if Labor were to go and have a look at their own track record, what they would find is that they are responsible for about 650,000 hectares of land being sold overseas. So, from the government's point of view, we believe we took the right steps in toughening up the legislation. Whether the bid for Crayford Farms from the Chinese entity meets that legislation is a matter for the ministers charged with that responsibility in the Overseas Investment Office.
Are you happy with the way the Overseas Investment Office is operating at the moment?
Well, I've got no reason to question the judgment. I've reviewed them, but in the sense of any decisions I've seen them made, I have no reason to question it so far.
If the Chinese bid wins and they, obviously use Mancorp to manage the farms, does that seem back to front to you? I mean, David Shearer said that makes us tenants in our own land.
Well, my view has been that the wholesale sale of land in New Zealand is not in New Zealand's best interests. And that was why we sought to toughen up the Overseas Investment Act. I don't have the most up-to-date data, but I'm sure Maurice Williams in office will have it. My understanding is that less than 1% of all farmland is currently owned by foreigners. Now, process isn't perfect in terms of understanding that, because when a sale is made to a foreigner, if they then go and sell that back to a New Zealander, they don't require OIO approval, of course. And so what we know is what the maximum amount could have been sold to foreigners, but we don't know that it's still in their hands. So at around about 1%, I don't think that we have a substantial issue. There's been sales of farms to foreigners. German pension funds have been buying in the South Island recently. There have been other buyers from overseas. But in terms of the data that I have, the sales have taken place in the 3 years that we've been in office have been pretty modest.
But what do you make of a government agency managing land, New Zealand land, on behalf of the Chinese?
Well, I don't want to speculate on any particular transaction until I see a transaction that's presented to me. If I see that, then I'll comment on it. But there are all sorts of JVs that are proposed in lots of different entities and commercial arrangements across New Zealand.
Well, the Crown will be presented tomorrow on the applications.
Sorry, what was that?
Will the Crown be represented in the proceedings tomorrow?
I don't know the answer to that question. Sorry, yeah, I'll defer that to the General.
Will the ministers make their decision publicly? Will they announce that as soon as they've made it? Or will they follow a different process, which is often these things aren't announced, are they?
Well, if they're going to meet the 31 January timeline, then they'll need to make the decision soon, obviously, and they'll publicly communicate that.
So it will be announced publicly at the same time it goes back to the OIR?
That's my guess, yeah.
Was the Cabinet briefed at all on the dot-com case?
Again, there was a discussion about that. Not extensive, but there was a discussion. So a couple of things that are probably worth running through in that particular case. So I'm sure you're aware of this, but the tests are slightly different between residency and between the Overseas Investment Office. So in the case of residency, what has to be taken into consideration is the record of the individual, which certainly is taken and can be taken into consideration. Because Mr. Dotcom's record was effectively clean through the clean slate provision, his record was clear. So essentially he had no record. He self-disclosed that he had convictions, but his record was clear. Under the provisions of the Overseas Investment Act, it's not the record that ministers have to consider, it's the convictions. And they are never swept away despite any clean slate provisions. So what I've asked my officials to do is to go away and have a look, because there's clearly a potential anomaly there between the Overseas Investment Act and between the immigration rules. And I've asked them to go away and look and see whether they think that anomaly exists and whether it needs to be closed. The second thing is that the Immigration Department has looked at internally Mr. Dotcom's file, and I've been advised that they found that all of the correct procedures were followed, that it was appropriately handled, and they're satisfied with the way the decision was made. In both cases, both in terms of the Minister's decision to decline the application to buy the property in Coatesville and the official's decision to grant residency, they were what I would describe as an on-balance decision. In other words, they wouldn't have cut either way.
Should there now be an inquiry about perhaps the other nine people who were admitted under this category that Mr. Dotcom was admitted under?
Well, I don't have any reason to suspect any particular need for an inquiry. I'm satisfied that the law is working. In the case of the Overseas Investment Act, actually, his application to purchase was declined. As I say, what there is a discrepancy potentially between those two tests, and what I've asked officials to do is to advise me whether that test needs to be closed.
Well, so on that OIO decision, did the OIO recommend to the ministers that Mr. Dotcom's application be declined?
I don't have that ten. I'm not sure the answer to that question, so you need to take that up with the ministers and who are charged with that, but all I know is the decision they made was on balance not to accept it.
So in terms of the immigration issue though, was the minister told that Mr. Dotcom had convictions against his name, but
Yes, that's right. So under the no surprises policy, Jonathan Connors, the minister involved, was advised that this decision had been made. I sort of hasten to add that, you know, while some people say that every decision should be kicked to ministers, about 500,000 applications are made a year for residency for a whole range of reasons. So people come up for student visas, all sorts of things. It's not unusual for someone who has who's had a criminal record to be granted residency. So it happens every day, but there are plenty of people who some fall foul of the law and ultimately wanted to take up residency in New Zealand. In the case of Mr. Dotcom, as I say, they were historical. They weren't deemed to be serious enough to preclude him. His record was clear, and the officials checked for the German police to ensure that they were comfortable.
Mr. Did immigration look at how he obtained the money that he invested in New Zealand and those government bonds, whether it was done legally?
Look, I don't answer that. You'd have to take that up with the relevant minister. But, I mean, I think it's well acknowledged that he has access to considerable resources, and that's one of the reasons why the Crown has been lodging an application for him to be remanded on bail, because he presents significant flight risk, because he has access to significant resources.
Do you know whether the OIO or the ministers on the investment decision knew that the American police were investigating him?
No, I don't think they were aware of that, no.
You what?
I don't think they were aware of that.
So you don't know what the Overseas Investment Office recommended?
No, I don't know.
Do you see it?
It's declined by the ministers.
Do you see it as an anomaly that he was granted residency and, in terms of that, was given a tick in terms of his good character, but then was not allowed to buy the land he wanted to buy because he was not a good character?
Yeah, so then I acknowledge that there's two different tests, and you know, I think I can see why both decisions were made, but it does seem a little odd that someone can't buy a house but can be granted residency. I think that's something officials need to go away and give me some advice on.
Just to be clear, though, the immigration officials could have considered his criminal convictions even though he had a clean slate, correct?
That's right. They could have, but what happens, though, is the test in the Act, as I understand it, is his record, and his record was clear, and he had self-disclosed. He could have just said, I don't have a record, which was actually technically correct, but, of course, he had a clean record, but had previously been convicted. So he'd self-disclosed that information.
Prime Minister, the idea of your electorate secretary being appointed for chair of New Zealand On Air has recently been suggested in the media. Is there a problem with perception of conflict of interest in relation to that potential appointment?
Well, I wouldn't want to speculate on him being elected chair, because I have absolutely no knowledge of that. In terms of his position on New Zealand On Air, I support his appointment. By definition, all political appointments are, or appointments of that nature are political, as they're made by politicians. But this is a man who has 20 years' experience in broadcasting. I was, I think, at one point a producer of Close to Home. Has significant experience, and I think can add value to New Zealand on that.
Do you think there's a perception of conflict of interest in relation to making decisions about documentaries, about and his opinion that we shouldn't have politically charged documentaries in the lead up to an election?
No.
Do you think we shouldn't have politically charged documentaries in the lead up?
Well, I think it's a matter for a couple of bodies. Firstly, it's for the Broadcasting Standards Authority to decide whether something is fair and balanced. That's the first issue. Secondly, during the election period, I think it's for the Electoral Commission to determine whether something is an electoral advertisement. I mean, everyone's very cautious over that period of time. In terms of New Zealand On Air rules for what they're funded under what conditions, that's a matter for New Zealand On Air.
New Zealand On Air seemed to be quite alarmed and frightened, well, seemed to be quite reactive to the suggestion that there was a problem from Mr. Rackaway about the broadcast of that particular documentary. Do you have any view on the broadcast of that documentary?
Well, I didn't see it, so I can't comment on it.
Can I ask you if you're following the Republican primaries, would you consider releasing your tax return?
Well, no, because in New Zealand we don't do that. And in terms of them, I'm watching the primary, yeah, I was watching it in the United States.
Thank you. Well, it's only by convention that we don't. I mean, all political pressure.
Yeah.
People would be quite interested, wouldn't they?
I'm sure they'd be fascinated, but no.
just go back to the dot-com case. In your view, should have he been granted residency?
Well, on the balance of information that they had at the time, yeah, I think given the tests that were there, then yes, probably.
But if the case against him were to fall over, or the inheritance failed to keep his tradition, would you consider that he was no longer fit to hold residency, considering that an illegal firearm was found on his premises?
I don't have enough information on that to comment. I simply don't know. I mean, I understand he was found in a safe room with access to a weapon, but I don't know if that, you know, I don't know if that's media reporting. I don't know if the record was registered. I don't know any of that information. So I wouldn't want to speculate.
It was Crown evidence that it was a similar to a sawn-off shotgun, which makes it a pistol, therefore illegal.
Well, that may or may not be correct, but I don't have any advice on that.
So Jonathan Coleman was right in not intervening. You agree that Mr. Dotcom is...
Well, on the balance of the tests that are there in the law, I'm simply saying to you that the test of the law was his record, and he had a clean record. Now, whether he has subsequently gone on to undertake criminal activity is a matter that's before the courts, and it's not for me to judge that. That's for the US authorities, if he's extradited to the US, to make that case, and we'll find out in due course whether A, that case is made, and B, whether he is guilty or not. I wouldn't want to second guess that, but on the information that was presented at the time, it was well disclosed he had a record, but that record was some time ago and not deemed to be significant enough to preclude him from being a resident.
There was a media report challenging the clean slate with a minute.
Residency and the overseas investment. I mean, are you suggesting that there that you would like more of a character test applied to residency applications?
What I'm acknowledging is that there's a potential anomaly, and that doesn't necessarily make sense. I accept that there are different tests there. And what I'm saying to you is, you know, I want my officials to go and have a look at that and to give me some advice about whether consistent tests should be applied between the two different entities.
So are you suggesting that it's toughened up or it's diluted?
Well, I think it would be more likely to be toughened up, but that's all it.
Did the immigration officials Google stuff to check out potential residents? Because although his record's pretty clear, just a simple search would have turned up some pretty troubling things, I would have thought, about him.
Well, again, you'd need to take that with him. I don't know all the things they did. As I said, it was on the balance. In other words, no one's arguing it was clear-cut. But my understanding was the information that they had, of which he had all, you know, substantial information, was self-disclosed. So at no time did the immigration officials feel as though he didn't disclose information to them. Now, in hindsight, it might be different, but that will depend on a number of factors which are currently before the courts, and I would not offer a view on that.
So what was your reaction when you were briefed about the case? Did it raise the eyebrows with you that our system had let someone like this up?
Well, I was briefed by the Solicitor General under the No Surprises policy or convention, I guess, the day before the raid took place. It was very tightly held information. Very few people knew that that was going to occur. At the time, I didn't really take a particular view on his residency application because I don't know the exact details. I was simply advised at a very high level of what he has been accused of. I don't have a timing of when that might have happened, how that might have occurred. I didn't have his residency file on, but I wasn't involved in that. So I didn't know when he was granted residency.
I mean, you know, a lot of people will look at this before this case and just say, how did this guy get residency?
Well, because they need to go and look at the Act and ask themselves whether the Act was appropriately applied. And the answer is yes, in terms of the Act.
Prime Minister, while the appointment of Stephen McRae is a political appointment, they are supposed to leave their hats at the door, according to the quote that I think that they talked about when they're actually serving on New Zealand on air. In this particular case, it doesn't really appear that the electorate chairman has been leaving his hat at the door. He seems to have been directly complaining about the broadcast of the documentary which is something that TV3 does. I mean, the New Zealand Army doesn't have any power over scheduling a documentary.
Well, that's your summary of events. I disagree with it. And all I can tell you is he was responding to members of the public who had made complaints.
He was responding to members of the public. I mean, he was talking about the scheduling prior to it actually being broadcast.
Oh.
Regarding the situation with Christchurch City Council,
sorry.
Have you been sort of keeping tabs on what's been happening with Christchurch City Council,
yeah.
And do you think it's a kind of which the government might
make into
game?
Well, I can't rule out that that would never happen, but I stand by what I said during the election campaign, which was the government doesn't have an intention to replace the Christchurch City Council. Now, I think everyone would accept and acknowledge that in the last few weeks, the atmosphere on the Christchurch City Council has become more dysfunctional. My understanding is that the local government minister is back in Christchurch on Friday, meeting the council, and he'll be having some discussions with them.
Is it so dysfunctional that it's actually affecting the rebuild and the work that the government and everyone is trying to do down there?
Well, that would be our concern. If it got to a level of dysfunctionality that it held back the rebuilding process, that could present real concerns to the government. It's obviously very important for the 300,000 or 400,000 residents of Christchurch that their council functions well and with their best intentions at heart. So that's why the government has a greater interest there than it might have in other councils around the country, and why the local government minister will be back here on Friday.
Prime Minister, towards the end of last year, you ruled out the possibility of the government stepping in to assist the insurance market in Christchurch.
Yeah.
Do you now reconsider that in light of the new earthquake that occurred over Christmas?
Well, hopefully the earthquake or the aftershock that took place on 24th won't ultimately affect insurance provision in Christchurch. My understanding is that they are continuing to write new insurance contracts in the sort of surrounding areas, but obviously it's a setback. But it's not. It wouldn't have been unexpected by the insurance companies that would occur. They'll be aware that there's likely to be seismic activity for a considerable period of time, and it's obviously very distressing for the people of Christchurch. So, as I've always said, it's important that there's a functioning insurance market for Christchurch and for New Zealand. If we got to a point where it was impossible to provide that level of coverage, then the government would look at that issue, but I don't think we're at that point.
There seems to be a very serious problem with providing construction insurance for any housing in Christchurch or in the immediate area. And
I'm not sure that's completely accurate. It depends on whether you're trying to get new insurance from a new provider. So if you are in a position where you're moving from the red zone to another property, then actually you can get insurance cover, as I understand it.
But that doesn't actually enable the rebuild. I mean, we understand that the common understanding seems to be that the insurer said there needs to be 6 months between significant aftershocks, and that the last one was on June 13th. So around Christmas time, the expectation was that the market would open.
And I think it's quite as clear cut as that. I think there is, obviously the reinsurers are looking closely at what's happening in Christchurch, but I don't think you can characterise it as being quite as clear cut as saying there has to be a clean 6 months. There are a number of entities who are looking to enter Christchurch and provide insurance and reinsurance. New players are coming to the market. As I've said before, it's an issue that we are following and monitoring closely. But our preferred option is to work with those reinsurers and insurance companies to try and find a solution. Short of, I think the government stepping in, might provide some short-term relief, but also cause some very long-term problems.
Have you received,
as you've seen with the deposit guarantee scheme?
Have you received any advice on the feasibility of setting up a limited reinsurance scheme in Christchurch?
I haven't.
Monteiro says, Hugh Farmers says,
yep,
that dairy farmers would be taking a $6,000 a year hit in the pocket. Changes to the milk industry,
do you accept that? No, I don't. I think the package that's been put out for consultation, I think, is a fair package and recognises the virtual monopoly position that Fonterra enjoys in New Zealand. I mean, by definition, if the correct price is being paid for milk at the farm gate, then there is no subsidy that's taking place to overseas entities or any other entity. Secondly, if you look at those that are sourcing milk from two suppliers, Fonterra and their own pharma suppliers, there's only six of those, and only two of them could be defined as foreign-owned. So two of them are co-ops, in the case of Westland Dairy Company and one of the others, Tatarama. There's two of them are predominantly New Zealand-owned, and the other two have some foreign ownership. Secondly, it's important to understand what the consultation process is arguing, and that is that in the event that someone, an independent contractor or an independent processor, takes milk from two sources, then within 3 years they have to cease being supplied by Fonterra. So my view would be it's a sound package, but it is a consultation process, and we look forward to feedback from the industry, and then we'll work through it.
Do you think Fonterra's initial reaction was hysterical?
I don't want to characterise that. I understand that you know, this is their business and they care passionately about it. But on balance, I'd reject the proposition that somehow this is a massive offshore subsidy, because, as I say, we asked officials to look closely at raw milk pricing last year. They came back and said they believe that the price was appropriately set. Fonterra agreed with that. And if Fonterra's pricing is accurate, then by definition, there can't be a subsidy that's been passed on to independent processors, because the right price has been paid both to Fonterra suppliers and others.
Their reaction, though, was unusually strong, and they used pretty inflammatory language. I mean, is this a sign that the relationship with Fonterra and the between Fonterra and the government's falling apart a bit?
No, I think it's a sign that they care very passionately about this issue, and they'll be active participants in the consultation process.
Can I just ask about your speech tomorrow? What are your main themes that you're planning on?
Look, it's broad-ranging, but it's really setting out the government's agenda. We've got a big program this year. There's a lot of work to be done. It's a big legislative agenda. We'll be giving our take on what we think in terms of the economy overall. Obviously, we're conscious, like everybody else, of the situation in Europe. It'll be giving an indication of some other work streams that we have. So I don't think it's full of new news, but it is newsworthy in my view.
So have you got any?
Well, I'll leave you to determine that tomorrow.
The IMF and the World Bank have both in recent weeks downgraded their view of world growth.
Yeah.
And presumably that's hit our trading partner growth.
Yeah.
The Treasury measures as a key in the economy in particular. Have you had any advice on the likely impact on that?
Yes, and that's in the speech tomorrow.
Are you still expecting to return to surplus on tag at a time?
You'll have to wait till tomorrow.
Are you optimistic?
You have to wait till tomorrow, otherwise the speech will be less newsworthy.
You said on Monday that you were, so are you suggesting something changed?
We'll wait and see. There'll be a bit more information in the speech tomorrow.
Are you optimistic for 2012, though?
I am, yeah. Look, I mean, I think if you look at what's happening in Europe, yes, it's this, you know, there's been significant issues, and that's reflected in Standard & Poor's downgrading 15 countries in the Eurozone. Yes, the IMF have come out today and said that if they're not careful, then the growth that they downgraded in Europe from 4% to 3.3% will be downgraded to 1.3% of global growth. That's a significant issue. But the IMF also said today that there are a number of options on the table, and those measures need to be taken. So I sort of saw the comments by the chief economist that the IMF is somewhat of a warning shot across the bows of Europe, that they actually need to follow those steps.
So you believe that New Zealand will be in a better financial position this year than last year?
Well, all I can tell you is we're better placed than a lot of other countries, but that's contingent on New Zealand following the prescription that we campaigned on, which is getting back to surplus as quickly as we can, making sure our economy is as competitive as it can be, and making sure that New Zealand companies get the opportunity to engage in international markets.
Well, you campaigned on getting back to surplus in, by 2014-15. Is that still as quickly as we can?
Well, we'll wait until CSH.
But it could be tougher now.
Are you suggesting then, because on Monday you did tell my report that you were still going to meet that target, and in the last couple of days has that changed?
We'll wait until you see the speech tomorrow. I can say there's more detail in the speech than the comments I made on the morning report on Monday.
Tony Cockshorn is apparently going to be coming to Wellington to talk to you about the retrieval of the bodies in the front of the mine. What can you say about that?
Well, there's a process that's going on. You'll be aware that receivers have been working on a body recovery program. My understanding is while that was delayed because of a number of technical factors in the weather, progress is still being made, and it's likely that they'll be in a position to go into the miners' iron centre in as early as sort of February, March. There's quite a wide range of views on you know, if body recovery is possible, how long that would take, and depends on a number of factors that we can't answer at the moment, particularly in terms of how significant the rock fall is and the drift and what that presents. But everyone is hopeful that the plan that's been put together to both seal the mine and ventilate the shaft will be successful. In terms of, you know, his Mr. Cochran's meeting, yes, I can confirm I am meeting him in early February, but at this stage it's sort of early days.
Now, Labor's recall renewed its call for an inquiry into fracking. There seems to be some growing concern around communities about this process. Are you assured of its safety, or would you consider it an inquiry?
Well, we're not considering an inquiry. I think it's important to understand that there are two types of fracking. I mean, there's deep fracking and shallow fracking. Those things sometimes get confused. New Zealand's only ever engaged, as I understand it, in deep fracking, and there is no evidence to suggest that that is of concern to communities or that that should concern them. Shallow fracking is a different issue and has caused some concerns overseas. Government, as I understand it, or it's ultimately a matter for regional councils, but my understanding is that there's no applications for shallow fracking. On that happy note, I will back to my office.